To somebody just growing up in America, it probably feels pretty much just like a country. But to most of the rest of the world, it's far more than that. It's a symbol of so many things, good or bad. And that's why I think you find people fastening these massive symbolic values onto it.
You call America the mother of all brands.
Mm.
What are you thinking?
Well, it's just a weak pun, really. It's the mother of all brands because it's a big mother of a brand in its own right, but also because it's the mother which has spawned most of the famous commercial brands that we all know. The brands of America have always been its strongest ambassadors. They're wonderful products. And generally speaking, whenever they've arrived, or at least in the past when they arrived, they were like nothing that anybody had seen before. They were so much better value and better quality and more exciting and better packaged, and they did more. And that was how the American dream was proposed to people through these products like Coca-Cola.
You get it that really well in that Woodrow Wilson quote. You quote him as saying, "Go out and sell the goods that will make the world happy and convert them to the principles of America."
Yeah.
He said that to the International Council of Salesmanship, if I'm getting that right, in 1916. What did you think when you read that?
mixed emotions, really. Because I don't come from the American culture, I'm reasonably familiar with it, having lived and worked there, but I'm not American, and that kind of sentiment still chills me ever so slightly because of that blatant commercialism and that absolute unshakable and not even minutely ironic belief in the power of buying and selling to achieve great things. We don't think it's quite decent to talk like that in Europe. But on the other hand, joy at finding the quote because it so perfectly encapsulates how America got to be the mother of all brands.
Well, see, I don't think a lot of Americans would find unadulterated joy in buying and selling either. In fact, a lot of people might feel uncomfortable reading that in America.
People also often say to me, is it really necessary? Do we have to brand countries? Why can't we just run away from this idea because it's complex and it's difficult? The fact of the matter is that nation branding is self-defense, sometimes preemptive. It's self-defense against the trivializing tendency of mass opinion. It's people that brand nations. It's not governments. It's the world that's branding America as an insensitive bully or whatever it's doing at the moment. And that's why I often say that it's the primary responsibility of all governments in the 21st century to manage the national brand, because that's self-defense against the trivializing tendency of mass public opinion. If you don't brand yourself, then you will be branded.
You invented the concept of nation branding. You know, how is America doing?
America is not doing all that badly, to tell you the truth. Now, if you happen to believe that the natural place for America is on top, which is what Americans believe, because if you look at the way that Americans rank their own brand, they are unique amongst all of the countries in our panel in putting the USA top of the list on every point of the hexagon. The Americans all say that American culture, American governance, American people, American commerce, and so forth, is top in the world. It's certainly not that. That view is not shared by anybody. But it doesn't do badly. The signs are that American popular culture, the cultural products, are still extremely popular around the world. There is perhaps, and it depends how you interpret the data, beginning to be a bit of a worrying bleed through, if you like, between the undoubted unpopularity of American foreign policy and some of the other areas. Up until recently, the conventional wisdom in all these cases is people aren't stupid, and they know that the government isn't the people, and they know that the guy who decides to invade Iraq is not the same guy who puts the Coke in the cans. And people can detest American foreign policy but still enjoy drinking Coca-Cola or wearing Nikes. That's conventional wisdom. People can compartmentalize things in their mind without any difficulty at all. But up to a point is my theory. And what I'm beginning to wonder is if we haven't started to get rather close to the point where people say, actually, I dislike the behavior of the government of these people, and they did, after all, elect him, that government. I dislike it so much that I'm beginning to think that there are other things about this country I can't like. And remember that buying products is the closest thing to global democracy that we have. All of those people out there who object to the foreign policy of President Bush, they can't vote for him. It was said during the last presidential elections that if the rest of the world had voted for the US president, there's no way on earth that Bush would have got back in. So if you can't vote for the guy, and yet it's important to you wherever you live who is occupying the seat in the White House, the only way that you can register a vote is by buying or not buying American products.
It's sort of like you can't vote out Bush, you vote out the Big Mac.
Yeah. So I think what we're starting to see also is that the unpopular foreign policy on the part of American governments is not a new thing. America's been doing unpopular foreign policy for quite a long time. It goes way back into the 19th century and beyond. But the question that I'm asking myself at the moment is, are those episodes and the unpopularity which stems for them iterative or cumulative? If they're cumulative, what we're looking at now is Latin American episodes plus Southeast Asian episodes plus Middle East episodes. And it all starts to look like a critical mass.